This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland, the free voice of the internet. You'll hear it all here. I may or may not agree with my guests, but I can tell you this. They always get to say exactly what they want to say. No ifs, ands, or buts. Free radio at its very best. Listen on. Join the adventure. And welcome to another edition of Dreamland. Today we're going to have Wayne Dyer, Getting in the Gap, How to Have Conscious Contact with God. This is probably one of the very most beautiful and most powerful meditations I have ever known. I have been doing it ever since I learned it from the CD that comes with Wayne's book, and I tell you from my heart, this is extraordinary stuff. And it is, Wayne has made a huge breakthrough using the Lord's Prayer in probably the most extraordinarily beautiful way I have ever known. I've been meditating for 35 years, and this is something very, very, very special. So we'll get into it in just a moment. I want to urge you subscribers who are still on PayPal, and there are many, many of you who have not made the change over to the new subscriber system, to change over as soon as you can. The quicker you do that, the better it is for us to enable us to keep going. Next week, we're going to be doing something quite unusual on Dreamland. We are going to be talking with an author who knows how to talk with animals, but in a way that you can learn. It's not mysterious. She has a book out with exercises that is really a remarkable little book, and this is quite a remarkable lady, and I think that you're going to enjoy listening to her a lot. And there is so much more that we can do in areas like this. We think of animals as being, it's just sort of out there, but our animals, especially around us, can become an intimate part of our inner lives. And verifiably, she tells us how this can be verified. So this is also going to be a very important show. Her name, by the way, is Marta Williams, and her book is Learning Their Language, Learning the Language of the Animals. And wait until you find out that you can actually do this. It will change your life. It is a real but very humble way of greatly increasing your consciousness. And if you don't think you have psychic power, your cats and your dogs will teach you that you do and how to use it. Amazing. It's going to be quite a week. Now we're going to go to Wayne Dyer. This is something very powerful. Listen carefully. Learn this. Well, I'm very excited to welcome an extraordinary man back to this radio program. Dr. Wayne Dyer has been with us before for 10 Secrets of Success for Success and Inner Peace. If there was ever anyone, Wayne, who needed no introduction, it's Wayne Dyer. He has written numerous bestsellers, Your Erroneous Zones, Your Sacred Self, Started It All Off, and you have become one of the great voices of consciousness and for increased consciousness in the world. And I had a remarkable experience with your new book, Getting in the Gap, Making Conscious Contact with God Through Meditation. When I first saw it, I thought, oh, it's so little. It isn't little, Wayne, and thank you very much for coming and being with us. Welcome to the program.
Oh, it's my privilege to be with you again. We go back a long way, don't we?
Yeah, we have. Time is a passing, Wayne. My wife and I got confused last week as to whether or not it was 2002 or 2003. And for those of you who are younger listening to this show, as I know from our audience stats that most of you are pretty young spring chickens compared to me and Wayne, you'll understand later how that is easy to do. Well, Wayne, this is a remarkable achievement. The question begins with why meditate? And when I was reading it, I thought of a book by, or really a long, couple of long stories by J.D. Salinger. Are you familiar with Franny and Zoe?
Yes, I am, of course.
Well, of course. Mm-hmm. And in Franny repeats the Jesus prayer to the point of obsession, and then in Zoe, her brother attempts to show her that her attempt, her effort to eliminate her ego was itself egotistical.
Right.
And this kind of a conundrum is really at the heart, I think, of the study of meditation. Later on, we're going to talk about what happened to me, incidentally, when I did this meditation. So could you comment a little bit about this conundrum? How do we meditate in such a way that we don't kind of just do the opposite of what we do every day?
Yeah, which is to see how spiritual we can become. Just say how well I can do it and so on. That's why I put this book together, because the gap, we call it getting in the gap. The gap is the space between, and it's the space between everything that creates everything. In music, they say it's the silence between the notes that makes the music. I remember doing an interview with one of the people in the Red Hot Chili Peppers who had called me up, and they just had been big fans of mine. They'd gotten off of drugs, and apparently they had been like heroin addicts back a few years back, and they'd gotten into some of my books, and they decided they wanted me to interview them for a big program on VH1. And one of the musicians, one of the people who does most of the writing for them, said that the silence that is in the creation of music is just as important a part of the music as the sound is itself. And without that silence, we can't create anything, that everything comes out of the void. And I think that the way that we resolve the conundrum that you're speaking about is to take all judgment off of it, and just to understand that when we are learning to meditate, we are really making conscious contact with our source. And it is out of the gap, it is out of the silence, it's out of the void that everything is created. I mean, if you look at, you ask anybody out there listening in your radio audience, where did you come from? And they took a sex education class at one time or another, they probably will tell you, well, there was an occasion when my mother and father got together, and there was a little drop of human protoplasm, and in that tiny little speck is when I began. But if you investigate that speck and put it under an atomic or subatomic microscope, you'll find that there's no speck there, that our beginnings are not in particles. Our beginnings, the beginnings of everything, are in something that we call the source, or we call the void, or we call the silence, or we call pure energy, or whatever. And it's when we return to that energy and become what that energy is that we take on the capacity to create and to, I call it, regain the power of the source. And the power of the source, that is from which all of us come, is the power to heal. It's the power to manifest. It's the power to attract abundance into our life. It's the power to do virtually anything we place our attention on, as long as we stay in vibrational harmony with that source. And that's the only purpose to me for meditation. The idea that we get more relaxed, and that it takes the stress out of our lives, and it makes us more peaceful, and it even makes us look and feel younger, and so on, are all just wonderful side benefits. It's a way to make conscious contact with the source, and that's why I call it getting in the gap, and that's why we produce this. And you know, Whitley, this is one of the easiest things I ever wrote in my life, because it's something I've been doing for years and years and years now. I just sat down one day, and I just started writing about the power of the gap, and this is what came out.
Well, you know, you mentioned in this abundance, and I have to tell you, I think there is a reason we did not connect last week. As Wayne and I, you listeners won't know this, but we were going to do this interview together late last week, and for one reason or another, that it didn't happen. And I had listened to the CD that is connected with this book, but I listened to it not to use it for meditation, but to listen to it so I could understand what Wayne was doing since I had extra time with the book and with the CD, I sat down and I did the guided meditation in the CD, and it was not only, and I have, you understand, when I've been meditating now for nearly 35 years.
Really?
Oh, yes. I started meditating when I was working in the Gurdjieff Foundation many, many years ago.
Oh, really? I didn't even know you worked there. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I was involved in the Gurdjieff Foundation for 15 years, and I've written my own book about meditation called The Path. So I am into this.
Right.
And, in fact, I'll be honest with you. My ego said, oh, this is too simple, and this is... And looking for abundance, it reminded me a little bit of the Nomyo Rengeku Buddhist chanting deal that went on back in the 70s where
right.
people were chanting for Mercedes Benzes and stuff.
Uh-huh.
But here is what happened. First of all, doing the meditation, and I think it's one of the most beautiful meditations I've ever heard, and your voice in it is absolutely remarkable.
Thank you.
Oh. And I hope I'm not stroking your ego too much, but frankly, it's a really fine piece of work. And I found the gap. And I found out something else. At the time, I was blocked. I was writing a proposal for a novel. It's very important to me, and I was just blocked like crazy. Anne has also become a novelist, and she is waiting on tenterhooks for her first novel to get an offer on it, and having all kinds of trouble in getting an offer. And there was another thing in my life that I was having a lot of trouble with, a sort of blocked thing. All of this came unblocked. I could feel it come unblocked. That afternoon, instead of interviewing you, I finished the proposal in with ease, and it worked wonderfully. Anne got her offer for her novel at the end of the day. And the other thing that I was blocked in evaporated like mist before my eyes.
Really?
And this is why I think that we didn't get together last week, because that had to happen.
Yeah, if we would have, you
interview.
Wouldn't have listened to that, perhaps.
What?
I say, if we would have, you might not have even listened to it. You might have put it aside.
Well, I'd listened to it enough, but I hadn't done it.
Right.
And now you can hear the passion. Because it's incredible. It's as simple as that. I never had anything like that before happen.
Well, you know, Whitley, if you go back and read the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, which were written 500 or so years, they say, nobody knows exactly for sure when, before the birth of Christ, and look at something that he wrote called How to Know God, and just look at what he was teaching people, and you have to think about what the world must have been like 500 years before the birth of Christ. I mean, you know, way before the Middle Ages, and when people hadn't been out of caves very long, you know. And this was a person who was talking about the power of repeating the sound that is in the name of God.
You know,
and they called this sound Ah, the sound that's in, whether it's
yes.
Allah or Krishna or God or Yahweh or Kali, Durga, or the thousands of names of God. If the repetition of this sound, along with putting your attention on what it is that you intend to manifest, and if you go to, even if you, you know, 500 years, 600 years later, in the book of John, the opening line in the New Testament, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. That in the beginning, the repetition of the sound, and sound is really the access dimension between the world of the material, which is just a form of energy, and the world of the spiritual, which is just another faster form of energy. And the access dimension between these two worlds, which is the world where we do our creating, is access through sound. That's why music has played such an important role in the whole creative process. And I first heard this, oh my goodness, maybe 10 years ago I put out a CD called Meditations for Manifesting, and it's a teacher in India had read a book I'd written called You'll See It When You Believe It, and he said, I want you to take this meditation that's called Japa, and teach people to repeat this sound and to go into the gap with this sound. and they will be able to perform miracles. Well, I started doing that and teaching it. I mean, I've gotten letters from infertile couples. I mean, people who have been told it's absolutely impossible for you to conceive of a child. They started doing this meditation, and you know, 2 or 3 months later, they're pregnant and they're having children, and people are manifesting virtually anything that they put their attention on. It's like, and you have to almost willingly suspend your disbelief and say, if the greatest spiritual teachers who've ever walked among us, going back thousands of years, are telling us that there is a way to meditate and to repeat a mantra internally that is the sound that we make when we refer to that which is that which is divine, then why not give it a try? And it's been an absolutely magical experience for me. I'm so glad to hear that it worked so well for you and Anne, because it's something that just goes on all the time, and not only does it attract into your life what we want, but you get such an incredible sense of well-being while you're doing it.
That was true, very much so. I've done it 3 or 4 times since then. It's so beautiful, too. By the way, when you mentioned How to Know God, I went and grabbed my well-worn copy of How to Know God out of my library shelf, which is always at hand. It has been with me for very long time. I guess since 1981 or 82, uh-huh, when the Christopher Isherwood translation was first published. So, yeah, I agree. It's a marvelous book.
And he says right in there that it's the repetition of this sound, and it's in virtually every spiritual tradition that there is. It's the continuous internal mantra of repeating this sound and putting your attention on what it is you intend to manifest, and then detaching yourself from the outcome. That's basically what he was saying, is that to have a knowing, to have infinite patience about knowing. Have you seen The Matrix, by any chance?
I saw The Matrix, yes.
We happened to just watch it last night, because I guess the new one is coming out on Thursday. And
right.
My daughter and I were, it's coming out, or maybe it just did come out. It's coming out this month, anyway. And I was looking at they had a line in there where these people were able to do these absolutely, totally phenomenal things, and he was making a distinction between having a knowing and being able to just remove doubt. These superhuman beings had this capacity to go within and to train their minds to be able to make their bodies do virtually anything that they place their attention on. It just sort of reminded me of watching that last night.
The Matrix, I don't know. Sometimes I think we do live in a matrix, and it's a very different one from the kind of matrix they live in. It's a different kind of sleep, but I think that movie has struck such a powerful chord, because in ourselves we all know that in some way we're filtering out the real world around us, and we hunger not to. We hunger to awaken, as it were.
And isn't that what meditation does? Isn't that what it does for
yes,
you?
Yes, yes, yes.
It takes you to a place, and you begin to really see that anybody who's ever taken philosophy 101, the first things you hear are everything is an illusion. You know, the material world is an illusion. But then when you start studying quantum mechanics a little bit, and you start looking at the fact that particles that we think of as real, when you look at their source, don't come from particles, that the source of everything isn't, the particles themselves do not create more particles, that we need something called spirit, and there's an essence in there that most of us are not connected to. I just finished a book, I've been working on it for the last 6 months, called The Power of Intention, and I've taken intention, this won't be out for another year or so, but I've taken intention not as something that we do any longer, which is an act of the ego. You know, I intend to create something, I'm going to work hard, and nobody's going to stop me from getting what I want. You know, that kind of pit bull attitude.
Right.
It's like it's... I'm looking at intention not that way at all, but intention as a field, as a force in the universe from which we all emanate, that everything is intended into this universe, and that we separate ourselves from this field of intention, which has a quality about it. I mean, it's a quality that is receptive to all, that is abundant, endlessly abundant, and expansive, and kindly, and beautiful, and loving, And if you were able to hear this field of intention speaking, it would speak like it does in the Bhagavad Gita. I am the source of everything. Everything emanates from me. And when we separated ourselves from that, that's when we created all these things that we have problems and so on. And when we go back and reconnect to that source, and then vibrate to the same energy patterns that it vibrates to, that it creates everything from. And the only way to do it, the great teachers that I've had all say there's only one way to make that connection, and that's through meditation.
Now, let me ask you a question that has been in my mind for years, and I don't necessarily expect an exact answer, but I'm going to ask that question after we take our little break. We'll take a little break right now. This
okay.
is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We'll be right back. Wayne Dyer, Getting in the Gap, How to Have Conscious Contact with God, the book and CD, together marked down from 1795 to 1495 in the unknowncountry.com store. Plus, subscribers get an additional 250 discount. Get it. Don't miss this one. Listen now to some of the wonderful words from the CD that comes with the book, and you'll know why.
It has been said that it's the space between the bars that holds the tiger, and it's the silence between the notes that makes the music. It is out of the silence, or the gap, or that space between our thoughts, that everything is created.
This is Whitley Strieber, it's Dreamland, and we're talking with Wayne Dyer, Getting in the Gap. His website is drwaynedyer.com, and you should get in that particular gap for sure to see what is going on with Wayne Dyer, where he's going to be, and what he is doing. Because I think, I have to be honest with you, being in the presence of a man like this would be valuable. Physical presence would be valuable. And Wayne, why don't you, before I ask you this question, why don't you let us know where you're going to be in the next few weeks or months?
Okay, I'm doing something on, I just mentioned the power of intention.
Right.
And if people go on that website, drwaynedyer.com, and put their, put their email address on, that's how they do it, we can send them the schedule, and we can also send them, we're going to send them one of the chapters out of that book, and we'll send them a chapter out of Getting in the Gap as well. So that you can just sort of stick that on there. I'm going to be out at Miraval. Have you ever been to Miraval?
No, I haven't.
It's a wonderful spa, health spa, and a spiritual center out in Tucson. I'm going to be there for a week in November, and I'm going to be this is the end of May. I'm going to be speaking in Detroit right here in the next couple of days at the Unity Church of Today there, and then I spend the summer on Maui with my children. I have 8 children. And six of them will be there with me for 2.5 months while I'm doing the final edit on the Power of Intention. And then I'll be out in Denver in August, and in Portland. All of these things are mentioned on that website.
Well, keep up with it, folks, because I think that it's really valuable. If you want to see Wayne and be with Wayne, you should do that. Now, let me ask you this question, Wayne. Why is this there for us? It really is there. I know that.
Why is what? I'm sorry, I missed that.
Why? Well, when we open into the gap, there's something there for us.
Mm.
Why would it be there?
Yeah, what a great question. See, I think that if we're talking about a why, we're looking at purpose, and we're looking at what we're doing here in the first place. And I think that this universe is a universe that has a force behind it that is on purpose, and that all of us are here to be closer and closer to that source, that field of intention, that energy, God, whatever you want to call it, from which all things emanate, to stay in vibrational harmony with that. And it's the way to experience God. It's the way to, I call it, the experience of God. And there's a difference between knowing God and knowing about God. And you can know about God by, going to church services and reading lots of books on spirituality and hearing other people talk about it. It's very interesting. You mentioned,
yes.
and I'm beginning to see that we would have talked about the gap If we'd have done this show last week,
yes.
this week where we aren't talking about it, we have been in it.
Yes.
And we're talking from that from the experience of it rather than knowing about it. And
right.
It's the difference between religion and spirituality. You know, it's why religion calibrates so very low on a vibrational level, because religion is something that divides us. We carve our whole planet up into various religious organizations and just went to war with two sides, both of them believing that God was on their side. One side was Allah, the other side was God. They both have the same sound in them, and both people are using the exact opposite of what the source would do, because the source, God, never uses violence. It only creates out of love, and so it's like it's a way. As far as I'm concerned, it's a way for us to make and stay in conscious contact with that source. And all of us have that capacity. Even that says in the New Testament, even the least among you can do all that I have done, and even greater things. And the greatest spiritual teachers who've ever walked among us, and the ones who walk among us today, are the ones who stay in harmony, who are matched up with, who live in concert with this high spiritual energy that is the source of everything. And that's why meditation is such a powerful tool, and that's why that thing is there. It's to allow us to be that from which we came. But most of us take on something called an ego. We begin to believe from our teachings, from our earliest teachings, that we are what we have and what we do and what others think of us, and we begin to believe that we're separate from each other, and that we're separate from what we would like to attract into our lives, and that we're separate from God. And if everyone out there listening understood and knew that there is no place that God is not, there's no place that this source that we're talking about, that this gap, there's no place that this energy that allows everything to animate into the physical world, there's no place that it's not. And if you get that there's no place that it's not, then it's got to be in you. And if it's in you and there's no place that it's not, it also has to be in everything that's missing from your life, including the publisher that you want, including the
right.
abundance that you want. It's got to be in that. And so that manifesting and attracting into your life what you want through meditation is nothing more than realigning your inner world with, so that it connects to, rather than feels separate from, that which it is already connected to. And it has to be connected to it on that spiritual life force manner. And that's what's missing in almost everyone's life. That's what we get to know when we go into the gap.
You know, as we talk, I have learned the practice of going into the gap from the book and mainly from doing the meditation. And the meditation is in a CD that's in the book, by the way, folks. And
right, it's a book and CD package.
Yeah,
right.
And that CD, don't miss that CD. It's wonderful. Anyway, I find that I can actually go in the gap now while we're here on the air talking. I can feel myself doing it. And because why don't we go back so that the listeners can understand what I'm talking about? And why don't you describe the Lord's Prayer exercise?
Yeah, it's a great exercise.
Oh.
And it was, you know, it's an exercise that came to me in a seminar one time, in teaching it, because people had always, I got more questions since I put out the meditation CD years and years ago, a different one, called Meditations for Manifesting. I've had people say, well, it sounds good and all that, but I can't get in the gap. I can't get there. My mind is still always on it. So we can do it right now. We can do it right on the radio. I mean, and the interesting thing about this practice is that you can do it at a red light.
Yeah, you can do it.
People say to me,
like,
you know,
right
I don't
now.
Have time to meditate. I say, well, do you drive to work? And they say, yeah. So how many hours a day are you in your car? They say, well, I'm in a car an hour a day. I say, well, how many red lights do you think you stop at in your hour? Well, maybe 20. And so they stop for an average of a minute apiece. Let's say, so you got 20 minutes or maybe even 30 minutes of time that you're sitting at a red light during the day. The car has come to a stop. The traffic has come to a stop. Your body has come to a stop. Everything has stopped except your mind. And what is your mind doing? It's racing and going on and it's endlessly, and that's the only thing that hasn't come to a stop. And if you can allow your mind to come to that same stop that your body and your car and the traffic has come to, you're going to make this conscious contact. So when we talk about the gap, and I use the Lord's Prayer in this CD, I take a word. And it's like you can practice it right now. If you take, everybody knows the Lord's Prayer, Our Father. Father, which art in heaven. We'll just say those first five or six words. I do it through the first 10 words on the CD. And if you take the word, if you just close your eyes, if you're driving, you keep your eyes open, okay? But if you just close your eyes and just put the word our on the screen of your mind internally, O-U-R, just like put your attention, and for 15 or 20 seconds, you just hold your thoughts on the word our, and you just see it over and over and over again. You see our. And then we go on to the next word, and we say, in our mind, we just repeat the word Father, 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 Father. And then when you finish that, you go back into the gap that is between the words our and Father in your mind. Our, Father, back to the gap. And you can actually feel yourself slip into that gap, and now while you're in that gap between our and Father in your mind, what you can do is repeat the sound that is in the name of God. So you would just repeat the sound of God while you're in that gap. Allah, Krishna, Yahweh, whatever it is that you, whatever persuasion you have, but that sound, the sound of Ah, and the sound of Ah, by the way, is very important. Patanjali explained it this way. He said that it's the only sound that you make in your body that requires no effort, and creation is an effortless perfection. So that if you hear me talking right now, you could see that the sounds that are coming out of my mouth come from the movement of my tongue and my teeth and my lips and my jaw. Somehow I aspirate air through one of these four elements, tongue, teeth, lips, and jaw, and I can make a sound. But the only sound that I can make if I don't move any of them is the moment that I change anything, the tongue moves, the lips move, the teeth moves, the jaw moves, and new sounds. But if I don't move anything, the only sound that I can make is the sound of ah. And that sound is the sound that's in the name for the Creator. And it's also the sound that is in the is in the creative process of everything on the planet. And it's like, as you go back to the New Testament, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word itself was God. And the repetition of this sound, and so we've gone to our and Father, and then back into the gap. And then which art, you put your attention on which for 15 or 20 seconds, and then on art for 15 or 20 seconds, and then in your mind, you slip back into that gap. And you can feel yourself going back in your mind into that gap. And it's the only time when you won't have any other thought, you'll just experience it. And then the moment that you are ready to move on to the next one, you repeat that sound of ah again. And you do that exercise for about 3 or 4 minutes till you get through the first 10 words. And then you put your attention on what you intend to manifest by repeating that sound. And believe it or not, as strange as it may sound, and many of you might think this is just too weird to be possible, but our greatest spiritual teachers who've ever lived all have told us the same thing. That sound is the access dimension to the world of spirit, which is the world from which everything on this planet is created. Everything in this world was born in a night, as William Blake said. Everything was born in a night to perish in a night, while the soul sleeps in forms of beamless light.
Wow. And I think to myself, and the Word was God. And I see that sound in a whole new way. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We'll be right back. Wayne Dyer, Getting in the Gap, How to Have Conscious Contact with God, the book and CD, together marked down from 1795 to 1495 in the unknowncountry.com store. Plus, subscribers get an additional $250 discount. Get it. Don't miss this one. Listen now to some of the wonderful words from the CD that comes with the book, and you'll know why.
It has been said that it's the space between the bars that holds the tiger, and it's the silence between the notes that makes the music. It is out of the silence, or the gap, or that space between our thoughts, that everything is created.
This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We're back talking with Wayne Dyer, his new books. Excuse me. Wayne, you know, I am so... I was so deeply into the meditation, I sort of... I'm coming back into... kind of into this... Am I coming out of the gap? What's happening to me? Anyway, his new book is Getting Into the Gap, Making Conscious Contact with God Through Meditation. And way back in the interview, about 20 minutes ago, you spoke a little bit about religion being a divisive influence. And I was reminded of a statement that was made by a man I met in Toronto in 1998 under very unusual circumstances. He was more than an ordinary man. I wrote a little book, a transcript of the conversation with him, and he said this. He said, "You don't have religions. Religions don't have victims." Meaning real religion would not have a victim. And I wonder now, what was your thinking in choosing to focus the meditation on a prayer that is a religious prayer?
Right. Because I think that religious prayers, just like the... I wrote an entire book based upon the prayer of St. Francis, which is called There's a Spiritual Solution to Every Problem.
Yeah, wonderful book.
Thank you. And he said, you know, his prayer is... I said when I did the PBS special on that book that this is not a prayer. This is not a religious prayer. This is an 800-year-old technology. And it's a technology for problem solving. And if you listen to the prayer of St. Francis, which is, I'll just give the first few lines, he says, "Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace." He's not asking anybody to join anything, to get up an organization, and he's also not asking for peace from God. He's asking to become an instrument of peace. He says, "Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. Where there is sadness, joy." And I think of that as a technology, because everything, every one of those first words are nothing more than lower energies. When you're in a dark room, you're in a room of very low energy and absence of light. And you bring light to the presence of darkness. If you're about to strike a match in a dark room, you don't have to warn the darkness that you're about to bring light into the room, and the darkness has to scurry. When you bring darkness, when you bring light to the presence of darkness, not only do you nullify and dissolve the presence of darkness, but you convert it to light. It becomes, that very energy shifts into a higher energy. When you bring love to the presence of hatred, when you bring joy to the presence of sadness, when you bring in pardon to the presence of injury, what you're doing is you're bringing a higher and a faster and a more spiritual energy to the presence of that lower and slower energy. So while we call them we call these things religious prayers, they're really, St. Francis was really, if anything, he was pretty much opposed to everything that the Catholic Church was doing. In fact, his whole mission to do what he was doing back in the 13th century was based upon something that he had heard told to him when he was looking, at a religious artifact that said, "You must go out and repair this church that you have belonged to, because it was so corrupt." And so he offered, that kind of an energy. And I say the same thing about the Lord's Prayer. You know, "Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name." Now think about those words, hallowed. What does that mean? You know, it's like, that's where the word halo comes from. It's like, it's yes. Spiritual, be thy name. Again, it's the name of the Father. When you repeat the name of the Father, you are you're engaging in hallowed behavior. And, you know, if the Christians want to claim it, if the Jews want to claim it, if the Buddhists want to claim it, all we're doing very often with that is just finding something to separate us. And anything that separates us is very low energy. Anything that unites us and brings us all together. And that's why I pick words that make the most amount of sense. And throughout the Getting in the Gap, I've referred to the Quran. I refer to the Bhagavad Gita. I refer to the Old Testament, to the Torah, and remembering always that Jesus was not a Christian, and Buddha was not a Buddhist, and Muhammad was not a Muslim. These were people who had great high spiritual messages and high energy to bring to us. And other people took these words. I mean, I read a book not too long ago called The Reformation, and they claim that over 1 billion people have been slaughtered in the name of Jesus in 2,000 years. So, I mean, with all the Crusades and the Jihads and the Holy Wars and so on, I mean, we slaughter people in the name of God. And we ask God to be on our side. Even our president does that, and so did the president of Iraq do that, and so did the Taliban do that. And as I've often said in my talks, Whitley, it's like if we were doing this interview in 1776, we would all be here to hate the British. If you go 30 years later, we would be all hating the French. If you go ahead another 30 or 40 years, if you lived in the North, you'd hate everybody in the South, and if you lived in the South, you were supposed to hate everybody in the North because it was decreed that way. And then 30 years later, we hated the Spanish. We were at war with the Spanish, and we were on the side of the British. And then 20 years later, we hated the Germans, and then we hated the Japanese, and then it was the Communists, and then with the Iranians we hated, and then the Taliban, and then the Iraqis. And the enemy isn't... there's plenty of enemies for us to be assigned to. The enemy is hatred itself. I mean, it's like it's an energy that we have to learn to no longer radiate to or meditate to.
Because it's an energy that takes, it's a hand that takes from us.
It is absolutely. And as long as we have hatred in the world, and that's why meditation. When people ask me, I mean, I'll give you an example. Deepak Chopra and I. You probably had Deepak on your program.
No, actually, I haven't. But I do know his work, of course.
Yeah. Well, he would be a wonderful person to have on there.
Oh, I'd love to have him on.
Yeah, well, I'll talk to him about it because he would love to do it, I'm sure. And we put out some tapes together through Hay House. One of them's called Creating Your World the Way You Really Want It to Be. And he did this observation with me. They brought 7,000 people to California, to La Jolla, and they had these people doing meditation. And they were able to measure, this is a hard thing to measure, but they were able to measure something called serotonin, which is the only way you can measure it is through a metabolite that is present in the urine. And when you have increased amounts of serotonin, and serotonin is the thing that people take Prozac for, right? It's the feel-good enzyme in the brain. It's what almost all antidepressants are designed to do is to make the brain produce more and more serotonin. So they would do these meditation exercises, and they would then measure these. They would take these urine samples and see the presence of these metabolites, and they would see that after meditation, that serotonin levels are increased in the body, the feel good enzyme, if you will. But then they would observe people who were not doing the meditation, but were just in the energy field of those who were meditating. That is, the neighbors, the people in the surrounding communities. And they would find when they would measure their serotonin levels before and after other people were meditating, that their serotonin levels would go up as well. Now, the implications of this are just absolutely astounding. That when someone asked me on the radio not too long ago, what would you do about the problems in the Middle East? I said I would surround, if I were king and I could order it, I would surround the entire Middle East, all of the whole area of Palestine, the whole area of Jerusalem, all of that. I would surround it with millions and millions of people doing nothing but meditating. And when you do that, and you're in the energy field, because they said of Jesus that when he would enter into a village, just his presence in the village and nothing more would raise the consciousness of those people around him. And I remember being in a room with Mother Teresa once, and when she walked into the room, just her presence, she would emit pheromones of energy that were higher, and everybody had a sense of well-being just because she entered into the room. She was 4'10", weighed about 90 pounds. But it was that incredible high spiritual energy that she radiated. And when you meditate and make conscious contact with God, you literally change people around you. And if enough of us were doing it, I remember Maharishi did an incredible study in a prison in Africa, in Senegal, about 13 or 14 years ago, where they signed a contract to teach everybody in the prison, because there was such prisoner-on-prisoner violence. People were killing each other in these prisons and so on. So they required all of the prisoners to meditate for 2 or 3 hours a day, and all of the guards, and the wardens, and even the political officials. Everybody that was involved with the prison system was required to do this meditation for 2 to 3 hours a day, and they eliminated, within a year, all prisoner-on-prisoner violence. The recidivism rate dropped to almost zero. They didn't even need the prisons, they said, after 3 years of doing this, that what an impact that it had on people around them. And when I meditate in my home, or if my wife meditates in the home, the children become calmer just because of the fact that we are sending out a different kind of an energy, as hard as that is to grasp. There's a wonderful book by a man named David Hawkins called Power Versus Force, which talks about the impact that you make on other people when you yourself make conscious contact with God. You make other people feel calmer and feel more unified and feel kinder and feel safer just because you are sending out a different kind of an energy than a person whose energy field is very low and in the field of force.
That is really, you know, it's very telling, because if it applied to a whole culture, we live in what I call a culture of blame now, where everybody is judged and everybody is blamed, and we have a huge prison system. Just
2 million people in the United States now in prison, and only a few years ago it was 1 million.
And we have this attitude that we must hurt people in order to get justice.
Right.
And there is another kind of civilization and another kind of culture, just one step above this, which is a culture of compassion. And in the culture of compassion, we are not interested so much in hurting people, but in finding and giving them what they truly need the most, which is not necessarily pleasant, by the way. People hate the word compassion because they think that means, oh, you're soft on crime. But to try to understand what they need the most, that's the thing that's hard, to look at what is missing in the individual. Wayne, I want to get into, there is a wonderful section, a couple of sections in the book, and I want to get into the one first about the guidelines for meditation. You know, there's no such thing as a bad meditation, those on
right.
22 and 23. Because I want the listeners to just hear you telling, we have so many preconceptions about meditation, which is why we stay away from it.
Right.
And but these simple realities and truths make it much, much easier to open the door and bring meditation into your life. So let's just go. There is no such thing as a bad meditation. What does that mean, Wayne?
Well, you know, what it is, what happens is that people, when they meditate, they take the same attitude that they take into meditation that they take into their job or into any task that they might be, or into playing tennis or, you know, a golf game or whatever. I've got to win. I've got to do better than other people. I've got to have a higher score. I've got to make more money at this. I've got to be, you know, and there's all of this judgment about, you know, whether I'm doing it right or whether I'm doing it wrong, or is it good or is it not. Any time that you take in your life, any time you take in which you are learning to quiet your mind, shut down that inner dialogue, because shutting down the inner dialogue is one of the keys to higher awareness. That you don't have a mind that's in a constant state of chatter. You have to almost think of your mind as like a pond, and on the surface of the pond is where all the disturbances are. And so the rain is falling on the surface, and the dirt accumulates on the surface, and all of the storms and so on are on the surface of the pond, and so too is all the disturbances in your mind are on the surface of your mind. When you go down beneath the surface just a little ways, and you get to a place that is much, much calmer, much more peaceful. There's no dirt accumulation. There's no disturbances of any kind, and you're much more at peace. And you have to see that when you give yourself an opportunity to just get a little bit silent, that you're not doing anything other than just making conscious contact with God, and that in itself is its own reward. And even if your mind is a flutter while you're doing it, and you've taken it, if you're practicing, particularly if you use the CD in the back of this book.
Right.
You'll see that when you slip back into the gap between those words in the Lord's Prayer, And even if you're only in there for 10 or 15 seconds, you will notice a sense, an immediate sense of calmness coming into you. And that sense of calmness is your connection to your source. It's like it changes the frequency at which you are vibrating, and everything in this universe is an energy field that is vibrating to at one speed or another. And energy doesn't come in good and bad. There's not good energy and bad energy and moral energy and immoral energy. Energy is just high and low and fast and slow. That's how you measure energy. And when you speed the energy and allow yourself into that space, that's reward in itself. There's no bad meditation. You don't judge it. You don't find fault with it. You just allow yourself to enjoy it.
The thing that happens the most in people when they ask me questions about meditation, what has happened is they've become aware of the inner voice, and they realize that the inner voice is a very powerful thing in and of itself. And what's happening to them is that they're trying to quiet down and meditate, and they notice the inner voice more, and they think to themselves, "I can't ever shut this thing up," and that's not really the way to go about it, to kind of stump it out or crush it.
No, you don't want to try to defeat it.
Right.
And you don't want to make it your enemy.
Because you've got it right on the button here. Right?
Yeah. What you want to do is embrace it. And you know, Vivekananda, this great spiritual teacher from India, came over here, and when people said to him, How do I get rid of these inner demons? How do I make this conscious contact that you're speaking about? And he said, in the springtime, he said, go out and observe the blossoms on the fruit trees. He said, the blossoms vanish of themselves as the fruit grows. So too will the lower self, the ego, vanish as the divine grows within you. So what you're not trying to defeat this ego. You're not trying to go to battle against it. What you're doing is allowing. You just think of yourself as a container, and that it you've got a container filled with inner dialogue and constant chatter. And if you just bring some silence to that, it pushes. There's no room in there for that constant kind of chatter. So you bring spirit. You bring spirituality. You bring the presence of God through the repetition of the sound of God. To that, and every time that you notice that your mind wants to go back to chatter, you want to start thinking about, oh, I got to pick up diapers. Oh my God, I've got this much to do, and I got to get my car washed. Well, I got to, and it's like this constant kind of chatter. You just bring yourself back to this sound, you know, this sound of God. And as you do that, and it's like anything else, Whitley. I played tennis this morning for 3.5 hours. Played 5 sets of tennis. And I notice now, and I've been playing tennis for 35 years or so, I can take go out on a tennis court, and someone can hit a ball at me, and I can swing as hard as I can possibly swing at it, but I know how to make that ball have something called topspin on it, so that as hard as I swing at it, it still goes over the net, and then it comes back down on the other side. And I can do that 1,000 times in a row without making a mistake. But 35 years ago, when I was only in my 20s, and I tried to do that, the first time I went to do that, that ball just went sailing into the next court, and it went sailing again and again and again. But I've been doing it and doing it and doing it and practicing it, till now it's absolutely second nature for me to hit a tennis ball as hard as I can hit it and have it go over the net and come down on the other side without going over the boundary line. And the same thing is true of meditation. As you get good at it, it isn't, they're not the right word, not good. As you practice it and it becomes a way of life with you,
yes.
It becomes something that is, it almost becomes automatic. And then you become dependent upon it. I mean, I can't imagine my life without meditation. I couldn't sit down to write a chapter without having meditated before. And I now notice how noisy a society. Do you notice the noise in our society as much
yes.
as, do you?
Well, you know, I think what the noise is about is trying to drown out the emptiness. It's a very empty world, and we're trying to drown that out, and by essentially kind of beginning to scream.
Yeah, and do you ever notice how few people are comfortable with silence?
Very uncomfortable with silence.
Yeah, it's like if you're in a conversation with someone and we have silence, people get uncomfortable. They want to fill that void immediately. And We also have people who walk into it. The minute they walk into a room, they have to put loud music on it, or
yes.
Noise has to be, you know.
They have to have noise.
Right. And we don't live in a culture which cherishes and prizes the joy and the beauty and the benefits of silence. But we have to remember that everything comes out of the void, and it's the, and even that music that everyone is listening to, it's there's no music if there isn't silence between the notes.
Do you ever meditate with those you love?
I do.
What's it like? How do you do it?
It's and it, you know what it does, Whitley? It's it doubles the field. It it creates
yes.
more and more. It's just like I was talking about the people in the neighborhood. If I were to meditate in my home, I could impact the people walking by in front of my home. I literally could do that. And if I could get 100 people in here meditating in my home, I could affect the people in the neighborhood in the house down the street. And if I could get 1,000 people, I could get the people in the next town to be impacted by it. And I think, I always say, if I could get several million, I could, you know, we could really make a huge difference in the world. What it does is it shifts the energy field off of force. And force is the lower energies of anger and anguish and depression and fear and worry and so many of the things that you were referring to, in this empty world, that so many people have and that we talked about with the Matrix thing as we talked about earlier as well. What it does is see, when people are in low energy things like anxiety and worry and fear, depression, hatred, and these kinds of, emotions, these very low, energy thoughts, what is created is a counterforce. So that, if someone says, I hate you, people respond back with, I hate you too, and then we have to act upon that hatred. Whereas in the St. Francis prayer, where there is hatred, he said, let me bring love. If you can, And when people say, well, low-energy people bring me down, I always correct them and say, no, a low-energy person can never bring you down. You don't want to avoid low-energy people because they bring you down. I said, imagine Jesus being saying, go over there and help those thieves and say, well, you know, I just don't like being around thieves. You know, they bring me down. You know?
Right.
It's too silly. We laugh at such an absurd thing because the reason that low-energy people bring you down in your mind is because when someone hates you, you hate them back for hating you. When someone's angry at you, you get angry back at them for being angry at you. What you're doing is you are joining in, you are creating a counterforce with your low energy. Whereas if someone brings you a higher, faster, more spiritual energy to the presence of lower energy, it's like trying to pick a fight with someone who's not interested in fighting. It's like trying to argue with someone who says, you've got a good point there, I'll consider that. I haven't thought about that before. And then all of a sudden you've changed the entire energy. That's what happens when you meditate with someone that you love.
It's very interesting that on one level we're actually talking about a science, the science of meditation, as the science of managing energy in a way that is beneficial to us. Now, on page 51 of this book, there is what I consider to be one of the wisest pieces of advice for meditators that there is. And it's just a paragraph long, and it is really, really important. It starts with a question which I'd like you to answer for us, Wayne. Should I share what I would like to accomplish or attract with those closest to me, even those with whom I am in loving meditation? I added a little bit to the question.
Right. My answer to that is never.
Absolutely right.
Is that because what happens is that you have to understand that what you are attempting to manifest or attract into your life, if it's a healing, if it's abundance, if it's a divine relationship, if it's an improved relationship, if it's a just feeling better, if I just want to feel good, whatever it is that you would like to attract into your life, you have to understand that it will not come from your ego. It will only come from the source. The source is the key thing. It's always that whole idea that everything that originates in this world that started out in the world of spirit ends up in the world of form. And everything that you look around, everybody out there listening, you have 500,000 people listening to you at any given time. Every one of you, if you look around right now and see the automobile that you're in or the room that you're in or the you know, wherever you might happen to be, you might be listening out on your patio or whatever it is, just look around and know that everything that you can see and every person that you can see originated from the world of spirit. There's a source that we can find the particles, but the particles themselves, as we go back and go back and go back and try to find their source, they come from pure energy. So that what you want to create has to come from pure energy. The moment that you start explaining to somebody else what it is, or defining what it is, or telling other people about it, or asking other people's opinion about whether or not you can do this, or you're going to share this, no matter how close they are to you, you will have to find yourself having to explain it or defend it. And the minute that you do that, you involve the ego. You involve the part of you that has separated yourself from your source. Remember, the ego is an idea that you carry around about who you are.
Yes.
It's an idea that says, I am what I have, I am what I do, I am what others think of me, I am separate from myself, from everyone else. I'm separate from what I'd like to have in my life. I'm separate from God. That ego is something that is that you want to keep out of the creative process. And you want to bring so that's why you don't explain that at all. Everything is between you and God. Every conflict that you have in your life with another human being is not between you and them. It's between you and God. Can I find within me the capacity to be able to go to my source and bring that source energy to the presence of this conflict? Which is what I've had to do. I had a huge conflict with one of my own children who's 20 years old, who was doing drugs and got herself all messed up in areas that I had never even seen before in any of my children. I have 8 children. And at first I used shame, I used anger, and I used fear, and I used all of these kinds of things, and none of it ever worked because it wasn't between her and I. It was between me and God. And once I learned to go within and find that spiritual energy, go within, get quiet to meditate, and bring that energy to the presence of what it was that she was doing that I didn't agree with, I found her behavior beginning to shift, and I found her getting herself back on her own path to God.
Wayne, if we are not this idea of ourselves that we all carry around with us, that's named usually early on in our lives, John or Mary or Whitley or Wayne or whatever it happens
right.
to be named. Who are we?
We are the beloved.
Who are the? What does that mean?
We are all pieces of God. That's the key thing to remember. There's that we are the highest place within ourselves that is possible to be. There's a book written back, it was written by U.S. Anderson, I think it was written back in the 1930s, and it's called Three Magic Words. And you read the entire book, I don't know if you've ever seen this book, but you read the entire book, and you cannot find what the three magic words are, because they're not there until the last paragraph of the book. And the three magic words are, I am God. I am
Wow.
I am a piece of God. Not God in the sense of I am better or bigger or stronger than any, but I am always, you know, I am in you. It says in the New Testament, I am in you, and you are in me, and I am in the Father, and the Father is in you. The Father and you are one. And that's what we are. And what we've done is we've come here, we've separated ourselves from that idea, taken on this ego, and that's the source of virtually all of our problems, our concerns, and so on. And meditation and getting in the gap is a way to reconnect to that which we really are. We are all God. One of the great teachers in India was asked the question, are you God, in front of over 1 million people in Puttaparthi in 1999? And he said, yes, I am. And so are you. He said, the only difference between you and I is that I know it and you doubt it. And I think we have to learn to not doubt our own divinity. In fact, it's one of the 10 secrets in that book, 10 Secrets for Success, which is, you know, something to give to every graduate in the world.
A wonderful book. It is a book that I urge all of our listeners to get along with this one, and really very, very much because the secrets are really secrets, and really good secrets, important secrets.
And one of them is to treasure our divinity. Treasure your divinity. See yourself as the divine.
The courage to do that.
Right.
It's extraordinary because we all see ourselves through a glass darkly, as it says in the Bible. This is how we see ourselves, and we think to ourselves, well, it can't possibly be me. I sit down here, I get comfortable, I listen to the CD, I do this, and I don't feel any different. I don't feel what Whitley felt. I'm not getting that. What is holding a person like that back?
Well, what holds someone back is their doubt that they can have that. You know, we become what we think about, and if what we think about is what's missing, then we attract more of what's missing into our life. If we think about what we don't have, then we continue to attract more of what we don't have. If we think about what others tell us is possible or impossible, then what others tell us, even though we despise what others tell us, that becomes our reality. That highly functioning people who really do get it and know the gap and know what we're talking about here are people who never put their attention on not getting it, because they know that if they do, that more of not getting it will keep showing up. You put your attention on what it is that you intend to manifest, and then you go in there and you have that quietness. And when people say to me, I'm not getting it, and it's missing from my life, I say, well, what do you think about? Well, I think about what's missing, and I want to get more of it. I want to get what's missing into my life. I said, get your thoughts off of what is missing and put your thoughts onto what you intend to create in your life, and keep your thoughts there in your meditation and in your manifesting, and you'll see it showing up in your life. That's the difference between highly functioning people and people who live at ordinary levels of awareness.
That is so, so crucial. And you know, it's also important, I think, to remember that we're all struggling, and the struggle itself is the practice. If we were all angels, we wouldn't need to meditate. We'd be in this state all the time.
Exactly, and you will be. After you leave this body, you will be in that state. But while you're here, as my friend Ramdas said to me, honor your incarnation. You know, you showed up here, you're in this body, honor it, be involved in it, enjoy it, and be the spiritual being that I've always talked about in all of my books, that remind yourself that you're not here as a human being having a spiritual experience. You are here as a spiritual being having a human experience, and live your life from that essence of being a spiritual being rather than as a human one trying to have a spiritual experience. You are. Who you are is a spiritual, eternal, divine being. Live on the active side of infinity. See yourself as an infinite, divine soul. And having a temporary human experience.
Honor who you are.
Right.
Yeah. It's so simple. Wayne, I would really like to thank you for this hour together. And normally we go an hour and a half, but I wanted to do this in a somewhat shorter period of time because I wanted to concentrate a lot in this interview. And I want everyone, a lot of our listeners, I can tell from the statistics, will listen to the first hour or so and then not the last half hour. So we're going to end this one here because I want it to be a whole thing in your mind. And Wayne, I know there's going to be something in you that you want to leave them with. And I'm getting the feeling that I should just ask you to take us out of this now.
I think the thing to remind yourself at every moment of your life is that you have within you the capacity to either be a host to God or a hostage to your ego. And I encourage you to be that host and rather than be the hostage.
Dr. Wayne Dyer, quite frankly, a remarkable experience talking to you today, getting in the gap, making conscious contact with God through meditation. Don't you dare think you can't do it. You can do it. Everybody can do it. There is no doing. It is there. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We'll be right back. Wayne Dyer, Getting in the Gap, How to Have Conscious Contact with God, the book and CD, together marked down from 1795 to 1495 in the unknowncountry.com store. Plus, subscribers get an additional $250 discount. Get it. Don't miss this one. Listen now to some of the wonderful words from the CD that comes with the book, and you'll know why.
It has been said that it's the space between the bars that holds the tiger, and it's the silence between the notes that makes the music. It is out of the silence, or the gap, or that space between our thoughts, that everything is created.
One reporter who loves mysteries is radio's leading science journalist, Linda Moulton Howe. She's an Emmy Award-winning TV producer, documentary filmmaker, and writer who investigates new and unusual aspects of science, medicine, and the environment. Today, she has a report for us on something extraordinary that has been discovered in Antarctica. They're fossils of just little insects, but they mean that history needs to be rewritten. Here she is from Philadelphia, Linda Moulton Howe.
Thanks, Whitley. Earlier in May, the journal Nature published the discovery of common housefly fossils in Antarctica that surprises scientists and could rewrite history about this now icy continent, the evolution of flies, and the cycles of global warming and cooling on Earth. Geologist and paleontologist Alan Ashworth, professor and chairman of the Department of Geosciences at North Dakota State University, led a team into the Trans-Antarctic Mountains, only 300 miles from the South Pole. There, rocks are exposed from all the churning of glaciers over millions of years on those mountains. The scientists were shocked to find fossils of what are called genetically higher flies. That means they're more complex, and that includes the modern-day common housefly. No one expected that. Continents were all one big landmass called Gondwanaland at least 200 million years ago. Then big tectonic plate movements began and pushed the landmasses apart into what we know today as continents. Were these flies on what became Antarctica before that split up? Or did they somehow get to Antarctica later? I talked with Professor Ashworth this week about whether the fly fossils are from a time when there was no ice at the South Pole, or was there a lot of ice when these flies were alive?
Yeah, good question. We're working in the Transantarctic Mountains, which are an area of uplift. These mountains then are being uplifted. And as they uplift then, the glaciers that flow from this great central area of Antarctica, the polar plateau, then are eroding down into those mountains. And so along these great glaciers then, the mountains and the rocks are all exposed in these polar deserts. And so we can, as geologists then, we can explore the edges of these glaciers, and we can find these deposits of the ancient glaciers. And that's basically what this sequence is, where we're getting these fossils out of. And we can then collect the samples just as rocks. So we're not actually drilling in ice or doing anything like that to collect the sample.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually just acting like regular geologists, except we're on a very frozen landscape.
These flies could survive only in a certain, I'm assuming, a certain temperature. And what now are the hypotheses about when these flies might have been alive flying around in Antarctica?
Well, we imagine the environment that they lived in was tundra. There are buttercups there, so there were like tundra meadows, and this is the environment that this particular fly was living in. There had to be then the glacier that is presently there, the Beardmore Glacier, had to be a fjord at that time. So there was a giant fjord then. It opened up from the Ross Sea all the way into the interior of Antarctica, more than 100 miles.
Hmm.
So there's a gigantic fjord, and up this fjord then, these plants and animals, including the fly, plus there's some beetles, plus there's some freshwater mollusks. These animals then had, organisms I should say, had been able to migrate up this field during this warm episode. I mean, the question for us as sort of, as me as a paleontologist in here, is had these organisms then survived all the time from that very early time in Antarctica? In other words, are these then the descendants of organisms that lived back at the time of the dinosaurs, or
65 million years ago?
Yes. And had they lived in all that time around the edges of Antarctica, perhaps in Antarctica at earlier times, and then during this time, we know after then the ice sheets and stars are formed during a warmer time, had they then been able to migrate in from the edges of the continent into this particular position, which is pretty interior in Antarctica? Or the other hypothesis then would be that they became extinct when the ice sheets formed at, you know, 23 or so million years ago. And then as the climate became warmer during one of these warm episodes, like one at 17 million years ago, possibly one at 3 million years ago, then these organisms, which might have been resident in New Zealand or Tasmania, possibly South America, then they were able then from those distant continental areas somehow or other to disperse onto Antarctica.
Hmm.
We can't solve that problem at the moment. We just don't have enough evidence to solve that problem at the moment.
So you've got the fossils, but you're not sure really how old they are.
No.
How do you think that your fly fossil will help?
What it does do in the sort of the, from the point of view of the evolutionary evolution of organisms, is that it tells us then that this particular group of flies were present in Antarctica, whereas before it was believed that they weren't there. And so it gives us some alternative ways of looking at fly evolution. We don't have enough evidence at the moment to sort of say that perhaps these higher flies might have even evolved on Gondwana and then have been taken to the northern hemisphere as the continents rafted apart in Gondwana. We don't have the evidence to do that. But it opens up the possibility that that could have happened.
And what you mean is, could the flies that you have found in the fossils have actually been buzzing around dinosaurs at some time?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And if so, and we know that there were dinosaur fossils at Antarctica, you're trying to fill in these missing pieces of a puzzle that can get up to about 30 million years ago, and then between 30 or 33 million and 23 million, there is a kind of mystery about what happened in the Earth's climate. And since 23 million years ago, it's sort of accepted that there's been a general and gradual buildup of ice there.
Yeah, the picture of climate change over the last 65 million years, okay, is there is a general cooling of the Earth's climate from the time of the dinosaurs of 65 million years ago. And what happens then is that until about 34 million years ago, the climate oscillates some pretty big swings going between warmer and cooler phases, but it's sort of generally on the warmer side. And then right around 34 million years ago, there's this big decline in carbon dioxide, and then once again after that, it goes into a more cooler phase of Earth's history leading up to the ice ages in there. But did the fly then, did this organism, was it flying around, or were its ancestors then flying around at the time of the dinosaurs? And did they then, as the climate oscillated, did they periodically move the distributions across Antarctica? Did they then, as the climate really started to cool down, were they forced to live just on the edges of Antarctica in tundra habitats on the edges? And then maybe in one of these late phase warmer episodes in Antarctica, was this fly then able to migrate along with all these other organisms, plants and animals, were they able to migrate up these fields and reoccupy the interior of the continent again?
Leaving the gigantic question, what forced all this to happen?
Yeah, what did? Well, I don't think that we have, there are different, say, hypotheses in there. Some of them involve tectonism on land and erosion of mountains, locking up then of carbon dioxide in rocks in the oceans. So the oceans then act as a sink for carbon dioxide. They then reduce the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which then leads to cooling. Once you get ice, you can have albedo effects of the ice, where you get then reflection of heat back, and so then there's a feedback. There's all sorts of complicated events occurring that can, once you start the process going, you can imagine that you can get this cooling, type of cooling occurring.
Is it fair to say that perhaps the Earth never had ice caps prior? to approximately 34 to 23 million years ago?
No, no. The Earth has had undergone several glaciations, and they go all the way back into what geologists call Precambrian time, so billions of years ago.
Will you be able to date the fossil of your fly very precisely?
Probably not. If we can get it within a million years, we would be extremely happy at this particular time.
Why is it so difficult to get a finer age?
The type of deposits that these fossils are occurring in are the deposits associated with glaciers. And any organic material that's in there, for instance, we think of ways to date than more recent sediments, like we would use radiocarbon dating. But radiocarbon dating is only good back to about 40,000 years. These fossils are definitely in the order of millions of years old, so we are beyond the capabilities of radiocarbon dating. Our best bet, and we haven't been able to find it yet, is to find that there would be volcanic ashes that would be included in these sediments somehow or other. They would be embedded in these sediments. So we might find a volcanic ash below the fossil-bearing beds and one above it, and then we could use the minerals that occur in the volcanic ash, the feldspar, and we could use then types of dating that are referred to potassium-argon or argon-argon dating to give age estimates. In that case, you know, if we were able to do that, we probably could get within tens of thousands of years if we had access to the volcanic ashes. But so far, we haven't discovered any volcanic ashes at this particular locality.
How long will it be before you think you've got a pretty good age?
I'd like to think that in a year's time we would have a good age, but that's probably pretty optimistic. We're assuming at the moment the age of this fly is going to come somewhere between about 17 million and 3 million years ago. There is an outside chance it could be older.
And that these little flies that you now have in the fossil, they have flown around in Antarctica, and nobody knows for sure exactly how long. They aren't there now, though.
No. This type of fly is no longer present in Antarctica.
I've always thought that one of the hardest things to understand about the Earth is imagining that a time when the poles had no ice, and then the condition today of 3 miles thick ice, and how does that machinery get set in motion that something can go from trees and insects and open land to 3 miles thick of ice?
Yeah, and I think that you have to think in terms of, you have to think of a very different Earth. We know then, for instance, in the Cretaceous period, that seafloor spreading rates were a lot different than they are now. They seem to have been faster. You have to think of perhaps more CO2 being in that atmosphere. But exactly what sort of drives all those changes so that we can understand the rhythms of climate change? We got some clues. I think we know that the relationship of the Earth to the Sun, the so-called Milankovitch cycles, we know that they're involved very much in the rhythm of ice ages. But what's changing these big values in CO2 is one of the great quests that the climate scientists are trying to solve.
It's really a mystery.
It is a mystery.
And the fly sort of sits juxtaposed against all that ice as a question that we have about ourselves. Humans seem juxtaposed against a possible global warming trend, but as you've pointed out, there have been so many variable cycles of warming and cooling that nobody understands. Could we in the future be faced with another gigantic ice age?
Oh, yeah. I think that most scientists who work in my field, we work in this last part of geological time, we would argue that this last ice age we had was cyclical. The ice ages, glaciations seem to occur on about cycles of about 100,000 years. At least for the last million, there's a change in frequency of them, but at any rate, the bets would be, I think, from the majority of us, that there is going to be another ice age.
So with that, you have this, to me, this wonderful, huge mystery of the South Pole with all of this ice on it, with the very strange paradox of this little housefly that is challenging everyone to try to understand, when exactly was it there, how much ice was there or was not there, and when have the ice sheets built up, and how long did they, or how far did they melt down? It's really quite amazing how little we know about Antarctica.
And how much it changes, too.
Constantly.
Because it's certainly changing a lot now, and we are, you know, it's just a fascinating time. For example, the Humboldt Current has moved north, which originates in Antarctica and has been responsible for sunny South Texas being cloudy for the last 4 months, but no rain, of course, and also across Mexico. So it's always, things are always changing in that, and it's a fascinating report and really interesting to think of the fact that the dinosaurs were bothered by flies too.
I know, and your point about the water, the change in the current, Humboldt, when you go back in looking at Gondwanaland being that big landmass that suddenly got pushed apart by whatever set off the tectonic plate movement, one of the interesting hypotheses that scientists have been kicking around for the last 20 or 30 years about what caused this huge buildup of ice on Antarctica in the first place, and no one really understands that. But one interesting idea is that when South America and Antarctica got separated by the tectonic plate movement, that for the first time, there was this deep water passage that opened up. In fact, they call it the Great Passage. And for the very first time, Pacific Basin water entered into the Atlantic Basin, and that, they think, started a current that would go completely around Antarctica, and that this cut off any warmth that once upon a time was being transported around what was Gondwanaland. And that, just that change, separating land and a different temperature in the water, may have started to set up the machinery that produced this enormous South Pole ice cap.
It's absolutely fascinating. Thank you, Linda, for a very, very interesting report. And this is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We'll be right back.
The work of Linda Moulton Howe, the amazing work of Linda Moulton Howe, follow it on earthfiles.com, but also read the books, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 1 and Volume 2, unique in all the world, like so many of the books on the unknowncountry.com store, Mysterious Lights and Crop Circles. Want to make your own mind up about crop circles once and for all? Well, read Mysterious Lights and Crop Circles. Crackerjack Scientific Reporter tells it like it is. Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 1 and Volume 2. You can hear her referring to them in this report. Get them. They are endlessly fascinating. Large format, profusely illustrated, big books and wonderful books. Beautifully written. What a journey Linda Moulton Howe has taken through life, one of the all-time most remarkable journeys of reporting in all of history, and you are in on it. It's happening as you listen. Read Linda Moulton Howe. Listen to Linda Moulton Howe. Go to the unknowncountry.com store right now. Click on it. Go to Linda's books and get them. Wonderful books at the Crop Circles section and the Amazing Science section.
Thanks very much for listening to this edition of Dreamland. Next week we're going to learn how to communicate telepathically with animals. And once again, as I said earlier, if you think that's impossible or you can't do it, think again. The author we're going to have next week is going to tell you just how to do it and how to verify it. So you might be very, very surprised. Do tune in next week for what's going to be a truly unique program. Thanks for listening to another edition of Dreamland Online. Remember, Dreamland comes online every Saturday afternoon at 3 p.m. Central Time and remains available for 1 month thereafter. This is Whitley Strieber. We'll be talking to you again next week. Thank you.